Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What is the best approach to pull families out of poverty? Well, this has been a subject of debate since the emergence of the middle class in our country. While the American dream is a statement of social mobility and the opportunity for prosperity, and nearly all Americans believe in this ethos, segments of our population have found the dream to be illusory. So back to the question, what's the best approach to lift people out of systemic poverty? Well, my guest today is trying to answer that question. She's the executive director of Ascend, the Family Economic Security Program of the Aspen Institute, and Mosley. She served in similar roles in other foundations prior to joining the Aspen Institute. Ascend is focused on a two-generational approach, offering specialized educational assistance for children while offering vocational training and job placement for parents. When Ascend was looking for models, they found Tulsa's Community Action Project, which has long advocated this approach in their career advance. Mosley and the Ascend leader team visited CAP earlier this month and recently announced that Stephen Dow, the executive director of the Community Action Project of Tulsa, would be joining the organization as a fellow. And Mosley joined us today by phone to talk about their approaches to combating poverty. And Mosley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You recently visited Tulsa and saw the Community Action Project's Career Advance, which is not only helping low-income children, which CAP's been doing for a number of years, but also today offering career training for parents. Now, your organization is a big believer in this two-generational approach to poverty. First of all, what was your assessment of this particular program here in Tulsa?
Well, I think I really want to point out first and foremost that I think Tulsa is doing some of the most exciting work in the United States when you think about the two-generation approach. And just sort of to ground us, the two-generation approach is really based on a seemingly simple concept about if we are really trying to break the intergenerational cycle of poverty, that does sort of seem to go from generation to generation far too often, is how do we start really taking a hard and strategic look at sort of the strengths and the opportunities, as well as some of the needs of both low-income parents and their children together. And it sounds straightforward, but so often systems or programs are not set up to bring the needs of parents and children together. And coming to Tulsa and seeing the Tulsa CAP project and the Career Advance program that has really blossomed under the leadership of Stephen Dow was just extraordinary. And it's really, he's a fellow. Our program here in Washington, we're part of the Aspen Institute, which is focused on values-based leadership and taking on some of the most critical issues. And a hallmark of our program is actually identifying leaders out there working, whether it be in policy or systems or on the ground, that are really doing pioneering work. And we were really delighted to have the opportunity to support and identify Stephen Dow, who's the executive director of the Tulsa CAP program, to be one of the inaugural Ascend Fellows. So the trip to Tulsa was really to see his team in action working with kids and parents and families in Tulsa, and it was amazing.
What most impressed you about the Career Advance system that they're working through, where I think they have parents actually looking at primary like nursing and health information technology training and the like, and the children are doing early childhood sort of learning?
To see it come together where you can see in the morning we had a chance to be with the children over at the Eugene Field Center and see the children just sort of beaming, learning, happy, healthy, just doing what young kids are supposed to be doing at a high-quality early education environment, and then scooting over and having lunch over at the Tulsa Tech Center with many of their mothers in this case. And it was just extraordinary, both being on a path for education towards that leads towards a path towards economic security. So I think without question, that sort of headline that we saw or felt when we were on our sort of the end of our trip was just the incredible partnerships and the network of support that's coming together and that the Tulsa CAP program and Career Advance has so carefully woven together so that it's engaged administrators, it's engaged teachers, coaches, to really have the sort of unwavering focus on how are we advancing forward the parents and the children together. And it's everything that can be as simple as working on when are the class schedules being held so that it can make sense for many of the mothers. They're working in jobs, they're raising children, and they're going to school to get on a path to a job that has advancement opportunities in the healthcare field in this case. And to see that kind of seamless strategy and making the systems to the schedule to the drop-offs all come together takes a great deal of work and a great deal of intentionality, really, again, being completely focused on how are we moving the children and the parents forward together.
You know, you talked about just seeing the drive of the parents actually to succeed. And we want to talk about stereotypes when it comes to people in poverty a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about why so many of our programs that are out there in anti-poverty and bringing people out of low-income situations seem to be one generational. It's either Head Start for children or job training for adults. But this idea of merging the two, is it gaining traction, or is this still an uphill battle to get, you know, big organizations to start looking at this two-generational approach?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it's definitely gaining traction. I think that one of the reasons for it is, and it is developing, so it's not, you know, we are just building the path. It is emerging. But in today's climate where it is just so constrained regarding resources and budgets, that aspect, as well as just constrained on there's not a lot of extra time out there for any parent or, you know, person out there. And so I think a lot of this is really trying to spark how can we really align our systems and resources so they're just more effective. A lot of these programs, be it Head Start, when you just think about, you know, a wonderful program like a Head Start that is primarily there for children but did bring in the parent engagement piece to it, that's probably one of the most advanced system out there. But when you think about workforce development, for example, they're really looking at, let's just get that adult to work. And it doesn't really matter, or it's not rewarded in the system to say that person also most likely has children. And especially when we look at younger adults and younger low-income families, the chance to sort of break the cycle of generational poverty by looking at a young mother and a young child moving forward together has real potential upside, both for their trajectories and prosperity and economic security, but also from a budget perspective. And so I do think we've learned so much on areas like early childhood development, where there's actually documented sort of returns on investments, if you will, ranging from anything from 7 to 16%, depending on which economist you're sort of, which report you're reading. But a lot of that is saying, let's invest these resources so that a young person stays in school, goes on a path to become employable versus falls out of the system and has a sort of the more deficit-oriented cost that can come when you fall out of the system and not on the path towards education and economic security.
You know, one of the
a lot of this is trying to head that off.
Right. One of the things, you know, as you make a case for it, is that it's going to take a long time to have a baseline to see what impact you're having. Has this two-generation approach been around long enough to really show different outcomes, or is this something you're going to just have to keep making the case for until you have that sort of length of time to actually see real positive outcomes?
That's a great question, and I think what we definitely, you're seeing pockets of real movement. And so in places like Tulsa, which Tulsa has been so incredibly strategic that it's working throughout the community with a variety of early care centers and spots and really working to leverage the capacity of Tulsa Tech. Just when we came in from as a national partner coming in to see what was being sort of woven throughout Tulsa was incredibly powerful. And you have also a leading labor economist and a leading early childhood development specialist that are part of documenting this model and taking those lessons and already thinking about how can they go ripple out further. So there's other communities out there across the country that are sort of actively learning from and watching Tulsa. There's a lot of groundbreaking work you're doing. As well as there are other programs, for example, in Minnesota, there's the Jeremiah program, which has a slightly different approach but still takes a two-generation lens, where they work with low-income single mothers, and they work with those that once they get their GED, they are open to live in a residential facility that is near a community college or, you know, higher ed institution, where they are on a path to continued education success for career opportunities while their children are receiving high-quality early education. And you're seeing, and just as they've been graduating class after class, their success rates are incredible. And it's a very deep intervention at a specific time for a family, but it has the ability to show the results of 90% of the women are working and still working in the jobs. The children's reading scores and ability to stay in school have increased. And so we've been sort of tracking, and this is really the role of the work here at the Aspen Institute. We're sort of the national hub, if you will, for sort of out there scanning each day. Where are the breakthrough ideas? And I would say Tulsa's pretty breakthrough. And then where are the proven strategies that can really move parents and children together out of poverty and towards educational success and economic security?
You know, the importance of parents being involved in this, I think you've written about how watching the parent do homework is a great motivator for the child. But this idea of both moving forward together, one of the criticisms of really quality early education is that unless it's followed up through the elementary years and the middle school years, is those advantages of this high quality early education, early childhood program tends to erode unless it's reinforced in elementary and middle school. Is it the hope that seeing the parent working on homework along with the child and the parent seeing the value of this education will be that additional motivation so that if they go to an elementary school, which maybe doesn't have the greatest opportunities, they're able to stick through those challenges because of parental backing?
That is an extremely astute comment and question. And I think it's one of the challenges why sometimes people stick by working one generation at a time. Early childhood has, I think, finally been sort of embraced and accepted of what an important lever that is and what an important opportunity, but we absolutely have to keep this continuum going and to not connect to the family and the community that a child resides in just does not make sense. And you'll see it play out with all sorts of comments, both the positive comments, which we've done national focus groups across the country with mothers and fathers of all race and ethnicity, talking about their dogged determination for their children, and especially the mothers are saying, you know, I want my children to be successful. My children will be successful. They will not make the mistakes I've made. They will have these opportunities, and really a sense of resilience and optimism that's quite powerful. And making sure to tap that and also continue to nurture that with a mother, especially, but it's also for both parents. It just gives that positive reinforcement and aspirational tone that keeps, you know, the family and the child moving forward. And that's part of the areas that we are looking. I mean, sort of social capital is a tough word out there. And it's sort of one where it's really the power of relationships at times. It's that hard to quantify, but I sort of sometimes think it's the secret sauce to how someone is able to sort of break out and to really succeed when they're in very tough circumstances. But it's thinking about the networks, the relationships, the aspirations, sometimes the faith-based support that people get that says, I'm going to continue on this path towards, sort of economic security and independence. And seeing that together with the parents is critical. Because on the flip side, you'll sometimes hear challenging stuff we heard a little bit in Tulsa, when a child or a young mother or parent is trying to break their cycle that they've been in, and potentially the community that they live in, where it's not the norm for both to be really focused on education, success, homework, not doing other stuff, and saying, like, hey, you're breaking from the community, when in fact the community is, and that's sort of a false play on that word, but it's sort of not the norm to go out and be successful, and creating that sort of sense of aspiration and example in the parent and the family and the community is what we're really trying to play and lift up and shine a very bright spotlight on that aspiration and on that resilience.
You mentioned social capital. This is sort of one of the three legs of your stool that you really think of as helping move families out of poverty and low income into the middle class. And that's social capital, economic supports, and education. That's the three prongs.
Those are the three prongs. And we, a lot of times I think both programs and policies try to look for that sort of silver bullet, that one answer. And having worked on the side of philanthropy for many years and looking at, you're trying to fund that thing that's going to be that most strategic lever, I think we have to look at how education and those key economic supports and that social capital, how they come together in a different kind of a formula. And it's not one versus the other. It's a really mutually reinforcing. And that's why I think when you have that sort of integrated perspective and you have a two-generation continuum, you are looking at an opportunity for just transformational change, not just transactional.
Well, I think if you just look at all three of those together, if you have only one of them, you're not going to go anywhere. If you have access to education, but you don't have the economic supports, you really can't afford to, you know, leave your child, for example, as a parent, to go get additional job training. If you have the economic supports without the education or the social capital, and the social capital is sort of the glue, I think, because there will be a lot of naysayers in some of these communities of poverty where, you know, people who have given up.
Well said. We're on the same page. And I think one of the things, it's really true, and it's a time where we're trying to take the challenging climate that is incredibly real, whether it's, you know, at the kitchen table or it's at, you know, the congressional level. These are tough times. And if we keep doing the same thing or we keep trying to do the same thing with less, we're going to keep getting the same results. And I have to say, having the opportunity, and we came to Tulsa, we came with some of our funding partners from the National Foundation, Kresge, and the Open Society Foundation from New York, because they wanted to see the brilliant work that's happening in Tulsa. And when we walked through just the Eugene Field School and we got a chance to meet with the teachers, we heard about drop-off, how are parents greeted and children greeted when they start the day, what kind of supports might they want to access during drop-off that make it a little bit easier. And at the same time, those kind of checkpoints, those welcoming points, have a great impact on higher attendance records, which have a higher impact on higher test scores. And just watching how it came together in such seamless ways under Stephen Dow's leadership and his incredible team it's really just sort of best-in-class work. And it's not just how this, you know, I'm just using this, we started our day at the Early Education Center, but it's located right next to the elementary school. So the school and the early education folks are already talking and thinking about how the children and the families are going to continue into the system. There's some public housing that's being woven in. It's just something that starts with, as I said earlier, the real clear focus on children and their parents. But then let's look at all the touch points of their lives. Where are they living? Where are they working? Where will they be so that we can just make sure we're making our services more efficient and effective?
My guest today is Anne Mosley, a vice president of the Aspen Institute. She's the executive director of Ascend at the Aspen Institute, their family economic security program. She was recently in Tulsa, and Ascend actually recently announced Stephen Dow, the executive director of the Community Action Project of Tulsa, as a fellow for their organization. And as you can hear from our conversation, obviously this program at CAP Tulsa is being looked on as a model. And she joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk a little bit about the focus, because the focus is on women and children, this two-generational approach. Why the focus on women and children as opposed to a two-parent household where you have men in the household as well?
Great question. And I think what we hope is when you take a two-generation lens, so its simplest form, it is about parent and child. So we're really looking at, you know, the close heart of a family. Why women and why sort of a gender lens is over the years, we've really been, I mean, all of our work really tracks the data. We're really sort of very research-driven, and then we look out in the field for leaders who are out there innovating and collaborating and doing the great work. But when you look at the data shifts, we've actually seen over the past 10 years a pretty significant increase in the number of single-parent families in the United States. The OECD has documented really, the United States is right now, we are at 1 in 4 children are being raised in a single parent family, and that's almost always a single mother family. That is, we are sort of far outpacing other industrialized countries. And again, we're not sort of in the judgment business. We're really tracking the data. And when you look at low income children, 7 out of 10 children living in a single parent family are living in poverty. And so for us, it really sort of, if you follow the data, you're really looking at where are the children and where are the families that are most vulnerable, and you come to women-headed or single-mother families. Now, a piece with that we also flip it, because we're not just trying to say, let's look at the need. We also want to say, let's look at the solution, let's look at the answer. And I think, almost everybody, that can get you in trouble. But when you look at sort of the great success and the momentum we've seen on the international front with people saying, hey, globally, we are seeing some really great results about investing in women and the power that can have on everything from building a democracy to building a family. And why don't we take some, not everything, but just take a real deliberate approach to thinking about the positive impact of investing in women and mothers intentionally here in the United States. So we're also seeing the role of women in many cases, the role of the woman as the breadwinner, as the one going to education increasing. So there's some real opportunities to build on that momentum. But I want to be also really clear that while, and we talked about this when we did our focus groups across the country, we went from LA to New Mexico, Detroit, New York, to hear from parents of all backgrounds, again, all low-income mothers and fathers, single and married, they're all actually asking for the same things. Low-income families are all, we used to talk a lot before the Great Recession about the real push and the drive for economic security. Well, for most families, whether it's two-parent or one-parent, it's really about the economic stability when you're in the low-income zone. People are living, one mother said, I just want to be able to go to the grocery store, buy what I need for my family and not have an anxiety attack. I just think we can't underscore enough the fragility that's out there and the need to really build pathways that say, I'm not having to choose between the safety or the education of my child or my ability to do better. And so it was a really interesting dynamic when we talked to, especially the single mothers in the groups, that they said, we're not looking for anything special. In fact, we don't want to be excluded or put into a special category. But the things they're asking for are the same things that all parents are asking for. And so I think it's important we try to look to make sure the needs are met of those that are most vulnerable. But we actually think the program, service, and policies will help advance, kind of make it a better pathway for everybody.
One of the things as I look at this, it's a great program, but it's also just for every family that's involved in a program like this, how many families aren't? 2, 3, 4, 5 families that, for every family that is. Is this two-generational approach replicable on a wide scale? Can we afford, really, to broaden these experiments if they actually are successful for a far wider population, which I know in most cities is far greater than these little pilot programs?
Yeah, I think we can't afford not to. Right now, we've got sort of 40% of children growing up in low-income families. And we've also got a time for the first time in the United States that the majority of adults don't necessarily think it's going to be better for the next generation. I actually think we need a pretty radical shakeup about how we're doing this. And there's both, I think we're building the case, we're building the models. It won't look the same in every community, and that's how it, every community has its unique strengths, its needs, its personality. But coming together and making systems and strategies work more effectively to help work with parents and kids together, I just think it'll take some upfront investments, but the yield in terms of what that can do for the next generation could be enormous.
All right. Well, be interested to see what happens. How long before we really have a good data set to see that this approach is perhaps the best approach for dealing with families in poverty? Is it going to take another 5 years, 3, 4 years, do you think, before we have really good data?
Well, I think it's the kind of thing, I think Tulsa, again, is leading the way and others are following, and we certainly as a national hub are trying to be a repository so that people can aggregate it up. But, people are tracking the numbers, and again, I sort of don't want to be a promotional advertisement for Stephen Dow and the Tulsa CAP program, but he is leading something where they are watching the numbers. They're watching the numbers for how are the kids doing, how are the parents doing, and I think they'll be graduating. They're just getting to the point where folks are going to be graduating, and then you're on the path to the job and continuing on. So we're seeing data, and to your wise point, is we need to continue to scale and grow it, but sort of programs like the Career Advance program that says to the community college even, hey, we're going to work with you to bring you a class of students versus an individual student, just even pushes the community college system at times to say, let's think differently about how we're working with sort of low-income students who are juggling so much to kind of keep it together. Like, how do we make this make sense for people with very busy lives? And so I think we're seeing shifts in basically how is the economic or job opportunities and career advancement opportunities for parents. You're starting to see kids read better, be healthier, be more connected, and then see how institutions can shift and change so that they work more effectively and really helping parents and kids succeed, so that the, you know, frankly, the funnel can get, can expand, and it's not just the lucky ones that are part of this system, but more broadly, how does it work for a broader number?
All right. You can learn more at your website, I'm sure. What is that website? Is it theaspeninstitute.org?
You got it.
Well, Anne, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, take good care. Thank you.
Anne Mosley is a vice president of the Aspen Institute and the executive director of ASCEND, the Family Economic Security Program of the Aspen Institute. She recently visited Tulsa as a guest of the Community Action Project of Tulsa. And ASCEND recently announced Stephen Dow, the executive director of that organization, as a fellow. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
A friend of mine whose son died a few years back says that on Sunday afternoons he usually goes out to the cemetery where his boy is buried and walks around, sometimes for hours. Does it help? I asked. He looked at me. Stupid question. I went to a cemetery a few weeks back for the burial service of a friend, a girl, late 20s, who died of heart failure. She had a 3-year-old and someone else's heart inside her. I got there early and walked around. Amidst the headstones, rows and rows of them, some having settled in the ground at weird angles, I saw people, heads down, talking, praying. What are people looking at? What are they looking for? Who are they talking to? Where are the dead? Are they in coffins? Are they in urns? If not, why are we here? My son wanted to be put on a burning Viking ship and set off to sea. I don't know why, but I started thinking about Martin Luther King Sr. His son, as you know, was murdered. His other son, Alfred, and you may not know this, drowned. His wife, Alberta, and even if you know this, you need to hear it again, was shot to death while playing the organ in church while he preached. In church. And yet Martin Luther King Sr. kept preaching, kept believing, kept, I'm assuming, coming to cemeteries, kept bowing his head. At Rose Cemetery, cardboard signs had been placed inside the ground so people could find the plot. Lacey was to be buried in the far north corner. If you're driving south on Yale between Pine and Admiral, you can see it. You can see her. It was a miserable day, or maybe that's just the way it seemed, the way they all seem at cemeteries. When the service started with the close friends and family on rickety chairs under an awning, the pastor talked again about Lacey, again how she's not here. She's already in a better place, he said, for the second time today. So where is that place? Near the canopy, there's a freshly dug hole, a green tarp, a mound of dirt. I wondered if it was possible to remember the dead without having to be reminded that they died. When I go to my mother's grave, I leave a pebble. It's a tradition in Judaism that proves I was there. The more stones left, the more others can see who came to pay their respects. Some graves just have a few pebbles. Some tears are for people you don't know. I see where my grandmother and grandfather are, my aunts, uncles, the spot reserved for my father. I see, too, where I will be buried. The dead can remind you of a joke you once heard, a season in which you once excelled, a taste of food you once had, a place you lived before anything bad happened. But cemeteries remind you of death. Here, just stones, names, dates, quotations. Religion tells us the dead return to God, go to eternal salvation or rest or reunited with loved ones. Some faiths talk of souls being recycled, reissued, reincarnated. You hope, pray, all of that. Some of that is true. I stand at Lacey's grave. I see another hearse pulling up, another group of people, heads down, waiting. The dead are not here, just the living.
Barry Friedman is a freelance writer and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.